But I'm going to try not to stick too much to it, but there's a lot of detailed information that, frankly, you can't really easily find anywhere else. So I'm going to try to both speak reasonably freely, hello, while at the same time, I recognize some familiar faces, while at the same time giving you some facts and figures and some quotes, because a lot of this material that I'm drawing on is from the Stanley Kubrick collection. As I mentioned before, this is material that partly people really haven't looked at before, so I think it is worth giving you a flavor of what you can find in the archive. And of course, there may well be Czech archives where you can find similar material for Czech filmmakers. You don't have to study Kubrick and live in or near London to do this kind of work. And I want to start with what I found quite a remarkable document, because part of the lecture will be dealing with the concept of independence. And as I will suggest, independence has a lot to do with contractual relations. Independence has a lot to do with how the contract you sign is designed. Now, you may not know this, but contracts are very, very difficult to get hold of. Contracts between anyone and anyone else are very difficult to get hold of. And indeed, in the whole Stanley Kubrick archive, there's not a single contract that he signed with anyone. Apparently, a lot of contracts include a clause which says that the contract must never be made public, including in an archive. But what you find in the Kubrick archive is a 20-page internal memo written by Kubrick about a contract that was offered to him. Yeah, so you don't see the contract itself, and in any case, it's not a contract he ever signed, but it's something that was offered to him. And this is a contract offer from the summer of 1964, and it comes from Columbia Pictures. Columbia Pictures, who had just produced and successfully released Dr. Strangelove, they offer Kubrick a follow-up deal, a two-picture deal. Or rather, they offer his production company, Polaris Productions, this deal. Okay, in response to this offer, Kubrick writes a long memo in which he almost rejects everything in the contract. Everything in the contract that limits his control over the film that he's making. Because that's what the contract is all about. The contract defines rights and duties. The more duties and the less rights you have, the more you might not want to sign the contract. And a lot of the rights that Columbia wanted was to interfere in the production itself. Now, in response to this, he wrote to his lawyers who were negotiating contracts on his behalf, and he stated, and I'm saying this because in a sense, Kubrick is seen to be a rather humorless person, but I think this quote that I'm reading to you is actually partly quite humorous, because it's so exaggerated that I think we have to both take the passion behind it seriously, but also there's a little bit of self-awareness that this is actually quite funny what he's asking. So I'm quoting from this contract, from his memo addressed to his lawyers about the contract. "You, lawyers, must constantly go on the principle that I cannot, will not, ever, in brackets, at least this year, be in a position when I must shoot anything or must change anything or must cast anyone because Columbia wants me to. I must have complete, total, final, annihilating control, artistic control over the picture, subject only to approval of the budget and approval of the two principal players." I think that's as clear a statement of what it means to be an independent filmmaker as you can get. But it is actually quite conditional. It is subject to certain things that the contractual partner is allowed to ask for. It is subject to whatever his position is in the year that he's asking for this total annihilating control. It seems to me what this memo, this particular quote indicates, is that Kubrick was very well aware that to make any such demands depended on the fact that he make successful movies. As long as he makes successful movies, he can ask for whatever he wants, because they're likely to give it to him. If one of his movies flops, then he will be in a very different position to make these kinds of demands. The other thing, of course, is that Kubrick is perfectly aware of the fact that he makes films with other people's money. Now, it's very clear that if you make films with other people's money, there's at least two things. They tell you how much money they give you. It's not like you saying, well, 10 million, obviously. They have to give you the money, so it's their right. So he does acknowledge that the budget has to be approved by whoever gives you the money. And the second thing he seems to suggest is, and that's implicitly, it has to do with casting. Because what he acknowledges through that little remark about approval of the leading players is that the film has to make its money back for the investors. Whoever gives you the money wants the money back. And at that time, there was a widespread perception that the best way to guarantee that the money would come back was to have stars in movies. So, of course, whoever gives you the money has to approve the stars you choose, because that's the only way that they might actually get a sense of getting their money back. Now, elsewhere in this memo, Kubrick refers to other trends in Hollywood which seem to support his demands that he's making in this. He's not saying, look, I'm unique, and you know, I'm Kubrick, and give me money, and you know, I'm going to make these movies, and you're going to get your money back, and that's fine. But what he's saying is that basically that's where Hollywood is going in the 50s and 60s. So he compares himself to filmmakers which are named in the contract, in the memo about the contract. Sorry, I'm going to get that confused for the rest of the day. And he mentions George Stevens, Otto Preminger, and Fred Zinnemann. Now, these are not just, you know, highly acclaimed directors. These are the blockbuster directors of the 50s and early 60s. He actually says, look, the major studios make these deals where they treat Stevens, Preminger, or Zinnemann as partners, as equal partners. Not as employees, but as equal partners. That's what I want. Yeah, and anything else, I'm just going to reject. Now, the funny thing, of course, is that these guys had been in the business for absolutely decades, and they really had proven themselves. And we're going to come back to this idea of Kubrick having to prove himself. But Kubrick actually felt, I think, that because he had made Spartacus in 1960, until then only flops, but then he made Spartacus. So he basically seems to suggest, and of course Lolita and Dr. Strangelove were successful as well, but the only blockbuster, true blockbuster he had made was Spartacus. So he seems to say, well, once you've made one blockbuster, you're in the top league. The studios have to treat you like an equal partner once you've done it once. That's his position here. And we're going to come back to that. But the curious thing about what Kubrick says in this memo is that even before he had made Spartacus, when he had made Paths of Glory, he had a good contract which gave him a lot of control over the project. And he says, obviously, the times are changing. The kind of ridiculous control that Columbia wanted to have over his films was not only out of keeping for a blockbuster director, admittedly only one blockbuster, but still, but it also was out of keeping even for unproven, commercially unproven directors, as he had been in Paths of Glory. He felt that if he had gotten a good contract in Paths of Glory, even though he was commercially completely unproven, he could not now possibly step back and accept anything less, especially since he also had, in the meantime, made a true blockbuster. Obviously, Kubrick found that the Columbia offer was offensive, really. Ludicrous. Completely unacceptable. Although I'm not going to say much about this now, what he did instead, he held out a little bit and he made a contract with MGM, although we don't know what the contract says. We can be fairly sure that not only was it a contract that had a flexible budget, let's not forget, he said, I accept that these guys have to approve the budget. But it turns out he actually was able, with the contract he signed with MGM, to go from $6 million to more than $10 million in the budget. That's a big spread. And secondly, he didn't even have to have stars in the film. So we really can see that Kubrick demanding, although somewhat self-consciously he's aware of the limitations and the excessiveness of his demands. But at the same time, he's confident that Hollywood has been changing and that his ability to make commercial movies and his ability to deal with the major studios were enough for him to get a contract for 2001: A Space Odyssey, which didn't ultimately even have a strict budget and certainly had no stars whatsoever. So we can see that in 1964 he sets himself up as something which is actually, I think, quite unique in Hollywood history to some extent. I'm going to maybe come back in the conclusion, in the second part of the talk, how there is, it's not quite as unique as one might think. But if you just look at it in terms of total annihilating artistic control, he does actually get it with 2001: A Space Odyssey, but he has to reject the Columbia offer first. What I want to do in this lecture, basically, is to just explore how this young man, he was 35 years old when he made this demand, how this young man achieved a career that would allow him in 1964 to ask these things, and then a few months later, with the contract with MGM, to get everything that he could possibly ask for. How is this possible? And in exploring this, I want to use the concept of independence as a way of making us think about the career that Kubrick undergoes in this period. Now, I must warn you that in some ways, I probably find the term independence not terribly useful. However, it's a term that is used so widely, and it touches on many of the key issues we need to address in order to understand the filmmaker's career. So, somewhat paradoxically, I'm going to sort of explain independence to you, but always put it everything in sort of inverted commas, because I might actually say that ultimately it's not a useful approach. However, it is one that is always taken by film historians and film critics, so I have to engage with it. Now, how do we start with the concept of independence? Where do we start? Let's start with the Oxford English Dictionary. That's always, for me, the best place to start, because, you know, they figured out, you know, over, you know, the many years that they wrote this damn thing, these thousands of people, they figured out what is a word supposed to mean. Okay. What's independence? It's the fact of not depending on another. Exemption from external control or support, freedom from subjection or from the influence of others, individual liberty of thought or action. How is this term usually used in film studies? Now, this is actually quite tricky because the term is used in so many different ways and in so many contradictory ways, but I want to suggest there's one major way in which people understand the term independence in the film industry, and that's the following. It is used by the trade press, Variety and things like that, by film critics writing for newspapers and magazines, and by scholars who write about independent cinema. The terms independent or independence are used when discussing the direct or indirect influence of the major Hollywood studios on the operations of a particular company or filmmaker. The greater the influence of the major studio on their operations, the less the latter's independence. Yeah, that's basically it. Now, there's a tricky one here. What's a major studio? Now, I'm not going to explain it. I could, but I'm not. But you just have to imagine Paramount, Fox, today Disney, Sony, then RKO, MGM. Those are the major studios. I'm not going to explain what a major studio is because that leads us into a whole different discussion. If you want to bring it up in any of the discussions, do ask me. So if a major studio exerts any influence over the film that a company makes or that an individual filmmaker makes, then we would consider that filmmaker to be less independent. If there is little influence, then we would consider the filmmaker more independent. Now, how do the major studios exert influence? It can come in very different ways. One is to do with questions of ownership and contractual relations. The other is to do with the nature of the major's demand for product. So let me run through some of these options, and they are quite useful because we're going to come back to most of them when we talk about Kubrick. So let's start with ownership. A major studio may own another company. Once you own another company, you might want to exert direct managerial control over that company's operations. You might not. Yeah, Disney bought Miramax and left Miramax basically initially on its own, because that's why they bought them, for them to do something different from what Disney usually does. But you always have the option to exert direct control over that company's operations. So if you own it and you make that choice, then that company is less independent. Or a film director may have an employment contract with a major studio. And that employment contract may give him or her a lot of duties and hardly any rights. If the company, the employer, chooses to exert the rights that they have by the contract, then of course we would consider the director to be less independent. Even if there's neither ownership nor an employment contract, a production company or a filmmaker may depend on a studio, it's all a question of dependence, for finance and distribution so as to be able to make a particular film and to get it into theaters. So even if you don't, if you're not owned by the studio, not employed by the studio, but you might need the studio because only they can give you the money to make your film and only they can give you the distribution network to get your film into theaters to maybe make your money back. If that's the case, of course, then you might have to sign a contract with that studio and a financing and or distribution contract. If that contract includes a lot of duties for you and not many rights, then we would say you're less independent. Yeah? Now, even if you manage to make a film without signing a financing contract with the studio, and without even signing initially a distribution contract with the studio, you somehow manage to get the money from God knows where, and you somehow manage to make your film. At that moment, usually, if the film costs any money at all, any significant amount of money at all, the only way to make your money back is to go to the studio with your finished film. And then, of course, what does that mean? That means that even if you, up to this point, never signed a contract with any of the studios, you think you're independent. Well, you're not. Because in order to have any hope to sell the film to the studio, you have to make a film that the studio might want to buy. Yeah? The nature of the demand of the major studio still influences what you do because you want to sell it to them. And what is even worse, usually studios don't buy your film unless they have the right to do everything that they want with it. That's how Miramax got big. They bought all these European art movies and then they re-edited the hell out of them to make them more commercial in the United States. Yeah. So you see that the question of independence is an extremely complicated one. I try to reduce it to whether a major studio, whatever that is actually directly influencing or indirectly influencing the film that you're making as a company or as an individual. We can see that there's obviously two different strategies to maintain your independence. One is never sign any contract ever with a major studio. Yeah? So if you have to take your film and travel from town to town and show it yourself, if that's the way to do it, or if you find a small independent distributor to distribute your film, that's fine. So one strategy to maintain your independence in the terminology that I use is to never sign any contract whatever. It's not a good strategy if you want to reach large audiences, to be perfectly honest. So what's the alternative? The alternative is to sign contracts, but to negotiate from a position of strength so that they have all the duties and you have all the rights. What I want to suggest to you is that Kubrick actually, by and large, followed the second strategy, with one exception, and it's a very curious exception, where he made a film that seems to have been made and ultimately was never connected to any of the major studios, and that's Fear and Desire. We're going to talk about that separately. But by and large, Kubrick chose the strategy where he's always willing to negotiate with the majors, but he tries to do so from a position of strength. Now, let me say a little bit more about the concept of independence. Because the funny thing about independence is that people think it's a good thing. Yeah, no one ever wrote an essay and said, oh, all this dependent cinema is all rubbish, isn't it? We should all be dependent, you know. No one ever wrote a book about that or an article. Now, the idea behind that somehow is that the major studios are evil. They do nasty things. They are politically, aesthetically conservative. And only by keeping your distance from them, from imposing your terms on them, can you make good movies. And also the other assumption is that somehow a contract with a major studio will be more stifling than a contract with someone else. Now, I would suggest you have to think about this very carefully. If you want to make a movie, you need money from someone. Whoever you sign a contract with, there will be strings attached. Who is to say that the strings attached to signing with an independent distributor or financier are any better than the ones that you signed with a major studio? That's one question. But perhaps the other question, which is trickier in some ways, but more interesting. And let's not forget, since no contracts are available for study, we don't know. We don't know what contracts John Cassavetes signed with the people that gave him the money. We don't know, because none of these contracts seem to be available. So we can't actually have a comparison. We can only go by the prejudice. Oh, the major studios, they're evil. They screw everyone. Yeah, but everyone else is out to screw you as well. Yeah. So how do you pick between one or the other? But the other issue is, just think about who has more opportunity to finance a thematically or aesthetically challenging film, a commercially risky project. A small budget operator who lives or dies with every individual film they finance, or a major studio that finances 10, 20, 30, 40 films a year, spreads the risk across all these films, and actually can make what they perceive to be solid blockbusters, and why not thematically or aesthetically challenging films, which they think might open up a new arena, a new market, a new niche, a surprise, an innovation, something like that. So I think we actually have to be very careful in thinking that independent cinema is good by definition, because somehow the contracts are less restrictive and somehow the films are more challenging. What's the major genre in independent filmmaking and has always been? Sex and pornography. That's where straight-to-video erotic thrillers, that's independent cinema. Yeah, it's not actually Memento or whatever. It is hardcore pornography and softcore pornography. That's the major output. And you can see why. Because these people need to know that first of all, they have contracts which tell them exactly what to do. And secondly, once they've done it, the people who've given them the money know that there is some money coming back, because these are very restrictive genres, I guess. Okay, so where am I? Not far enough. Oh my god. Let me see. Now, the other thing, of course, is there's something funny about independent production, because somehow, although there's a lot of talk about independent distributors, independent production companies, really it's about the independent filmmaker. Who is this independent filmmaker? Now, there's a tradition in even the OED definition of independence says individual liberty of thought or action. So it's not independence of the United States. It's the independence of an individual filmmaker. Who is this filmmaker? There's a long-standing tradition in film studies, at least since the 50s, to make the director, or director hyphenate, writer, director, producer, director, the filmmaker. Now think about this. Think about your own prospects. Who would you rather want to work for? You know, some pretentious piece of artistic ambition who wants to impose their vision on you, you know, when you are a cinematographer, or some Hollywood guy who, you know, live and let live, it's a big production, everyone does their job, let's just see whether we can all get along. What I'm trying to get at is, when valuing the independence of the individual filmmaker, we're devaluing the independence of everyone else working on that project. And there's a very strong bias in film studies in that. The genius of the individual director is supposed to be protected, not only against the studios, but against everyone else he usually, but sometimes she, is working with. Is that a reasonable assumption to make, that that's a good thing? Yeah, it's of course a big issue in so-called auteurist analysis, and I might come back to this a little bit. But we have to ask ourselves this question, whether this implicit and sometimes explicit claim that independent filmmakers somehow, it's good that they have their independence. Well, maybe it isn't, because it might mean that everyone else is more dependent, less independent on their films than they would be for a major studio production. Okay, finally. And we will actually come back to this, because Kubrick actually worked with independent producers. And so there we have this contradiction. Here we have an independent filmmaker who works with an independent producer. Well, they can't both be equally independent. You know, one has to be dependent on the other. And guess what? In this particular battle, Kubrick seems to have lost out. Because when he made Paths of Glory and Spartacus with Kirk Douglas, the independence of the star producer overrode whatever independence Kubrick might have striven for. Now, even if Kubrick has sufficient power over his projects, and that's something we have to be very aware with Kubrick, is it reasonable to assume that Kubrick, it's all in his head, and then he bullies everyone for months and years on end to give them exactly what he wants? Is that how we want to see how this independent filmmaker Stanley Kubrick operates? Or are there ways of thinking about the relationship between this particular independent filmmaker and his collaborators differently? Now, let me just to give you a tentative answer to this, quote from the memo he wrote about the contract in 1964. Because the memo seems to suggest a more flexible, open-ended, collaborative creative process that Kubrick wanted, rather than him imposing himself on his collaborators. In the memo, Kubrick rejects Columbia's demand that the production of a film must follow the script. Because that's one of the things that is part and parcel of a lot of these productions, is that you get a contract only on the basis of a script, and that script, of course, the assumption is that you follow that script. And Kubrick says that's nonsense. No matter how much time I spend on writing a script, I always need the freedom to change it. So he says, whenever I make a film, I always make substantial changes from the first draft screenplay. Very many times, the changes are thought up in the dressing room with the actors an hour before shooting. No sense here that Kubrick has it all in his head and then bullies his actors to give him what he wants. Quite on the contrary, he has a script. He may have worked on the script for years. Even as early as the 60s, it might be half a year, 1.5 years, 2 years that he worked on the script. Nevertheless, he's perfectly willing. He goes into the dressing room or he goes onto the set. Something happens. And of course, especially in the case of Lolita and Dr. Strangelove, something happens with Peter Sellers that really lets loose, and something, you know, amazing takes place. Kubrick wants to have this possibility. And I think we might want to suggest that both in his collaboration with scriptwriters and his collaboration with actors and in his collaboration with technical personnel on the set, and with people in post-production, he's open for change. Yeah, he wants the input. That's not the image that we have of Kubrick. There are very intricate jokes about Kubrick and God. I don't know whether anyone has ever found it on the internet. They can print it out and we can distribute it. Does anyone know which joke I'm talking about? Maybe not. But there's a very elaborate joke where basically God has a Kubrick complex. That, I think that's the gist of the joke. And I think we have to go against this. We must not think about it, because we're doing damage not only to Kubrick as the kind of artist that he was, but we're doing damage to our understanding of the collaborative process of filmmaking. Even in a case as extreme as Kubrick, who did want total, final, annihilating artistic control. Now, one final thing before I can start. Oh dear. There's one final problem we have when we do what we call director-centered auteurist studies, which is that there is a tendency to approach these studies teleologically, which means we assume that there is an inherent goal in the artist's work. It actually applies not only to filmmakers, it applies to any artist. We assume that even as a six-year-old, they sort of had the vision of what they wanted. They just didn't quite have the tools or the resources to do it. So there's this assumption that in an artist's work, the mature masterpieces are what it's all about. Everything before only leads up to it. Everything afterwards just means that they, you know, lose their capabilities. And I think this teleological approach is extremely dangerous because the teleological approach doesn't understand developments. First of all, it's not interested in developments. It's basically interested in continuities, underlying, assumed underlying essences. But also, it reverts chronology. It looks at fear and desire only as a precursor of Dr. Strangelove. Not Fear and Desire, a film made in 1953, made after Kubrick had been a staff photographer at Look magazine and a documentary filmmaker. It doesn't look at it the way it actually came about. It looks at it in reverse chronological order, from the future back into the past. And as a historian, I must say, it's not a good approach. Yeah, we have to look at things in chronological order. We have to be aware of our own perspective from the future, but we have to look at things in a historic, in chronological, if you want to understand them, how they evolve. So what I want to try to do is to avoid teleological assumptions, which is very difficult, very difficult. So what I'm saying is we can always refer anything that Kubrick does back to what he'd done before, but we must never, under any circumstances, relate what he does in one year to what he will do in the future. We always have to look back, never forward, when we try to understand what's happening. Okay, so now I want to apply some of these ideas. This is kind of the theoretical part. But then I want to apply some of these ideas. Okay. How did Kubrick become a filmmaker? I mean, in some ways, it's a strange question because you think, well, obviously, the only reason I'm writing about him is because he's a filmmaker, so the question why he became a filmmaker is irrelevant because that's what he is. But of course, it's very legitimate for us to ask, why did he become a filmmaker in the first place? There's an oft-quoted statement that Kubrick gave in an interview with Michel Simon in 1980. And this is a statement about the work that he did as a staff photographer at Look magazine when he started when he was just 17 years old. And Kubrick talks about what it meant to be a star photographer at Look magazine, and he says, "It was tremendous fun for me at that age, but eventually it began to wear thin, especially since my ultimate ambition had always been to make movies." Ah! Ultimate ambition. There we have it. Yeah? It's not me having assuming a telos, a goal. Kubrick has the goal itself. And from then on, you can say, yeah, he just wanted to, you know, go through this old star photography nonsense to make movies. Let's think about this statement a little bit. Let's just think about this statement a little bit. What do we make of the claim that he had always wanted to make movies? Does this mean that he already wanted to become a filmmaker when he first was introduced to movies as a small child? It's possible. Yeah, as a six-year-old, he says to his daddy, "I want to become a filmmaker." Now, if that was the case, would we have to take this seriously? Isn't that the same as another child saying, "I want to be a cowboy or a fireman"? Does that have any relevance, what a six-year-old says about their career plans? Okay, so we probably don't want to take it that far back. The other alternative is to say that he wanted to become a filmmaker as soon as when a teenager he was given, or he took from his father, a professional camera and took still pictures. Do we assume that as soon as he had a camera in his hand, he knew, "Oh, I want to become a filmmaker"? In that case, the fact that he took pictures for the school magazine, that he then became a professional photographer, probably a reasonably highly paid professional photographer at the age of 17 for one of the two leading picture magazines in the United States in 1947, I think he got the job, 46 he got the job, immediately after he finished high school. All of this would just be a diversion. Yeah, he's just biding his time until he finally can lay his hands on a moving picture camera in 1950-51 to make movies. I think that's also unlikely. Yeah, I think it's unlikely that someone who wants to become a filmmaker, once they get a still camera, would then faff around for, you know, he got the camera at the age of 12 or 13, and he faffs around until he's 20 or 21 before he can finally lay his hands on a moving picture camera. I think that's unlikely. I think it's much more likely to see it the other way around, that being a still photographer and being involved in visual storytelling, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this, that being a star photographer at Look magazine means to contribute to stories which combine images and pictures. By story, I don't necessarily mean a narrative in the sense of cause and effect chain, but a picture story could be descriptive. It could describe a place, or it could describe a profession or whatever in a series of pictures. But these photo essays combined several pictures and image and words into an overarching construct. And it seems to me it's much more reasonable to say once he'd done that for a few years, he realized it's actually quite interesting, but maybe it's more interesting if the pictures moved. Yeah? Okay. That's my assumption here. I'm going to say a little bit more about this. But even if we make this assumption, what can we assume about the kind of filmmaker Kubrick wanted to become? Because the first film he made, which was based, Day of the Five, which was based on a picture story he had contributed to for Look magazine, on A Day in the Life of a Fighter, the day of the big fight, what can we assume about the kind of filmmaker Kubrick wanted to become? Was it a documentary filmmaker, like, you know, the film that he made, Day of the Fight? Or was, you know, documentary and short film making just a step towards features? If he wanted to make features, what kind of features did he have in mind? European art films, or even avant-garde movies, which he was watching at the time in the late 40s, early 50s, in New York, both in art house cinemas and at the Museum of Modern Art? Or did he want to make Hollywood movies, like the ones he had watched since he was a child? Most importantly, for the purposes of this lecture, of course, we have to ask what kind of relationship with the major studios did Kubrick envision when he started to make films in 1950? Did he see them as negative, corrupting, limiting for any potential filmmaker? Or did he see them as, kind of the contrary, as an invaluable resource? Because only they could provide him with substantial budgets, top personnel, top collaborators, and marketing muscle. So all of these questions, I think, have to be asked. And I'm going to suggest a few answers in a moment. Now, in order to construct answers, I think we have to, well, obviously you're aware that, well, you have two kinds of sources, primary and secondary sources. Primary sources are produced at the time that you're writing about. In the case of Kubrick, we might talk about published material, such as newspaper articles, or unpublished documents relating to the production of films, such as scripts, or indeed documents intended for purely private use, like personal letters. So all of these things we might want to look at in order to answer the questions I just asked. The other one, of course, is secondary sources. The problem with secondary sources is they have to rely on some primary sources themselves. And once you start looking at the primary sources that some of the people that write about Kubrick use, you realize, frankly, sometimes they have no source whatsoever. They just make it up. So you have to be very careful about how any claim that anyone makes, you have to check the footnotes and see what is it based upon. How do they know what they know? And in some cases, you will find they have no reason to know what they know at all. They frankly just made it up. Or they took it from a book elsewhere, which in turn had made it up. The other thing that we can use are interviews. Interviews have a sort of intermediary status. They can either be, if they're close to the time that you're writing about, if they were conducted close to the time that you were writing about, we would treat them more like primary sources. If they're much later, we would treat them more like secondary sources. In any case, we would have to treat interviews, but also all other primary sources that we use in terms of what we consider their reliability to be and their possible biases to be. Yeah, so even if you find a document from 1953, it might have inherent biases. It might be completely unreliable. So we have to always take this in mind, keep this in mind when we use these sources to answer the questions we have. Now let's, with these considerations, these are more methodological considerations. So you get it all. You have theory, now you have methodology. It's more you get than in most lectures, at least in most of my lectures, because I don't usually do this stuff. So let's return to the questions I posed. What kind of filmmaker did Kubrick want to be in the late 40s and early 50s? And what kind of relationship to the major studios did he envision? Now, my starting point is the most thoroughly researched Kubrick biography by Vincent Lobruto. And he offers a quite surprising perspective on the emergence of Kubrick as a filmmaker. And that's based mostly on a single interview. And that interview is with Kubrick's school friend, Alexander Singer. They went to school together. They met each other in the photography club, and then they worked on the school newspaper together. And Singer recalls that at the age of 17, he, Singer, I quote, I decided to become a film director. And the way I was going to become a film director was to write, direct, and produce my own picture. So that's what decades later, Singer recalls about how he and Kubrick started to talk about making films, because Singer himself wanted to become a filmmaker. Interestingly, Singer did become a filmmaker later. He became a very successful television director. Singer produced an extensive treatment, wait for this, and a detailed storyboard for an adaptation of Homer's Iliad. I mean, the hubris of it. Here's this, you know, this guy. I mean, we don't know exactly how old he was. Well, no, he does say at 17. At the age of 17, he said, I'm going to make a big movie. I'm going to make the Iliad. It's ludicrous. But for some reason, the guy apparently wrote the script, did this detailed storyboard, and by the time he had finished it all, Kubrick was already working at Look magazine, and somehow, because he knew lots of important people in the media industries through Look, he actually managed to get Singer's, it's not clear what he sent to Dora Sherry, a chief executive at MGM, who replied with a rejection letter, obviously. Now, obviously, the whole story is probably not, it's not realistic that this really happened the way it does. But I think there's a sense here, at least, that these teenagers thought they could make feature films, and they thought they somehow could make feature films which they controlled, but the studios would give them all the resources for. It's a very curious idea, but that's not Kubrick, that's Alexander Singer. Now, after graduation, Kubrick works at Look magazine after they graduate from school, and Singer actually pursues his dream of becoming a big Hollywood director by getting an entry-level job at The Marge of Time. The Marge of Time is a screen magazine, not a newsreel. Newsreel has different items, and is shown before the feature film in the cinema. A screen magazine has one item. It has an extended piece, a documentary piece on something of topical interest, something of interest at the time when the piece is made. And The March of Time was the most successful of those screen magazines. And it was made by Time Magazine, or rather the parent company of Time Magazine, but it was actually distributed by Fox. So here already, Alexander Singer works indirectly for one of the major studios, 20th Century Fox. Kubrick, as I said, works for Look magazine. In this situation, we can see how Kubrick's ambition to become a filmmaker takes shape. Because in May 1948, Look published a profile of its young star photographer. He's of interest because he's so damn young. That's why Look thinks, oh, isn't it cute that we have such a baby photographer? We're going to write a little essay about him. And it's actually, it's sort of well-meaning but condescending, the whole piece. What is it called? Let me see whether I have the title here. No, I can't find the title. It has a funny title, but I can't find it. Where the... No, can't find it. I will eventually find it. Anyway, in this piece, Look magazine writes that he is a veteran photographer at 19. And it concludes the article with an outlook on Kubrick's future. In his spare time, Stanley experiments with cinematography and dreams of the day when he can make documentary films. Do you realize what is going on here? It's cinematography. Now, you could say that's just a term for filmmaking, but I think it could equally mean he wants to become a cinematographer, a cameraman. Yeah, that's what, for him, as a stills photographer, is the next logical step, to become a cinematographer. And that was well known already in that year. What did I say? What year was it? May 1948. It was already known that he wanted to move into movies, but as a cinematographer. Now, Singer recalls that around about that time, the two friends actually decided to make a movie. And the division of labor was what we would expect by now, that Singer was the writer-director and Kubrick was the cinematographer. But Singer was so obsessive, you know, having written a script and a detailed storyboard for the Iliad, when he makes a little short movie, which is a little love story, of course he has this humongous storyboard. And Kubrick says, oh, come on. He says, and I'm quoting Singer, quoting Kubrick, you have taken away all the choices from me. I mean, you've made the movie, there's nothing for me to do. And in Singer's account, this is the point at which Kubrick decides not to become a cinematographer who carries out other people's vision. That's how they understand it at the time. But who actually, in a sense, writes and then directs his own movies. That's the sense in which indirectly Kubrick comes into movies, because he doesn't want to end up translating Singer storyboards into pictures. I'm going to come back to that, because this might not actually explain very much. But that's the story that we get in what I think is the most reliable account. But even that probably is not very good either. But that just reminds you of the fact how difficult these things are. We can't make any assumptions. These are very difficult questions to answer. Okay. As soon as this whole love story project falls through with Singer, Kubrick decides in spring 1950 to make, and he starts making, a documentary short film called Day of the Fight. The film is about the, we're going to see it in a minute, the middleweight boxer Walter Cartier, who Kubrick had previously photographed for a story in Look, published on in January 1949. So Kubrick has already made a picture story, or he has contributed the pictures to a picture story about Cartier. He now uses the work he'd done for that picture story, and he tries to make that into a little movie. Now, the usual statement is that the film cost Kubrick $3,900 of his own savings. Now, you might say, $3,900, nothing. You know what the average salary of a person in the United States was in 1950? $3,000. So we're talking about an investment of more than the average person earns through a whole year. And Kubrick said always that it was his own savings from the previous years that he spent. However, Lobruto reports that Singer said that the budget was actually $4,500, which is even more, and that half of the money didn't come from Kubrick at all, but from his father. The father happened to be a well-off physician. So we're talking about independent wealth. We're coming back to this question. Now, it's tempting to see this first film that Kubrick make as an ideal of independent production. Yeah, we could say, oh, that's ideal. You know, this is all Kubrick. He initiated the project. He used his own and possibly his father's savings to finance it. And what is more, he executed most of the creative and technical work during the film's production himself. Lobruto states that, and I quote from Lobruto's biography, Kubrick started his professional career in cinema as a complete filmmaker. And then Lobruto quotes from a 1970 interview with Kubrick where he says, I was cameraman, director, editor, assistant editor, sound effects man, you name it, I did it. And it was invaluable experience because being forced to do everything myself, I gained a sound and comprehensive grasp of all the technical aspects of filmmaking. Lobruto ends his whole chapter in his biography on Day of the Fight by concluding that Kubrick's filmmaking autonomy in the production of this film had few precedents in the film community of the 50s. So it sounds like Kubrick emerges as the total independent filmmaker. Yeah? Total autonomy. Now, I want to explore what the limits of this autonomy are, even in this situation. First of all, if, and I find that quite likely, Kubrick actually needed money from his father, we can assume that the money came with strings attached. These might be not contractual strings, but almost moral strings. Namely, that I'm sure his father would have appreciated to get his money back. So the film would have to make some money to get the father his money back. In actual fact, Lobruto goes much further than this. Because he says, and that's a much reported story, and I can sort of believe it, that Kubrick had absolutely no artistic interest whatsoever. He just calculated, because Singer told him this fanciful story, that Marge of Time paid $30,000 or something for each short film that they showed. And Kubrick said, oops, I can do this for $3,000 or $4,000. I'm going to make $26,000 profit. Yeah. So Lobruto actually goes much further than what I suggested about the moral obligation that Kubrick might have had towards his father by saying, actual fact, forget about art. The funny thing, of course, is that Lobruto wants to say he's the total artistic filmmaker, while at the same time admitting it was just a money a money-grabbing exercise, which failed miserably, obviously, which then, of course, makes it more likely, oh, yes, he's an artist after all, because he is bad at making money. But that's the rationale, actually, that Lobruto suggests, and I actually believe that, that these guys thought, well, we're just going to make this little movie, and we're just going to sell and make a lot of money and, you know, go on holiday to south of France or something. So that's one restriction is, of course, that whether you owe your father money or whether you want to make a lot of money for March of Time, you, of course, have to tailor the film to the person you think will buy it. Yeah, you're extremely restricted. You're not at all dependent because the March of Time had a very rigid format. How long a film would have to be, how topical the subject matter would have to be, what the balance between image and voiceover would be. All of these things were strictly determined by the expectations that your potential buyer has for the film you're making. So the nature of the demand of the major buyer that you're dealing with, in this case Time Magazine and 20th Century Fox, determines the film you're going to make. That, I think, goes against the idea that Kubrick is the total filmmaker, the totally independent filmmaker. And of course, another restriction is that Kubrick did not do everything himself. That is complete nonsense. He did not do everything himself. He, of course, had to work closely with his subject, Walter Cartier. After all, the guy, you know, was in almost every shot in the film, and you're going to see that. So you had to work with him. Secondly, Singer. Don't forget, Singer is the guy who really wants to become a movie maker. Kubrick just stumbles into it, really. Singer is the movie maker, and Singer collaborates with Kubrick. In, amongst other things, he actually operates the second camera they used during the climactic boxing match. And interestingly, there's a young composer called Gerald Fried, who was a friend of Singer's, who gets roped in. Presumably, Kubrick didn't have the first... Well, he played in the school orchestra as well, but I don't think he was an accomplished composer or anything. So he needs someone else to do the composing. So once again, we have not the total filmmaker who does everything himself, but we have someone who works with collaborators, collaborators who have their own ambitions, free to become a composer, which he did. The funny thing is the guys that Kubrick worked with, a lot of them became leading people in their field in subsequent decades. Fried wants to become a composer, Singer wants to become a filmmaker, Cartier has his own career to take care of. Now we could say, okay, yeah, but Kubrick told him what to do. He was such a genius and he had such charisma that he had the vision of what the film was. I don't think so. I think that's very unlikely, partly because this is a project by friends who just think they can make some quick money, learn something about the film industry. Would these friends be willing to have Kubrick telling them exactly what to do and when to do it? I don't think so. I think the likelihood is that it was a much more collaborative enterprise right from the start. Also, let's not forget one thing when we talk about independence. This whole idea that Kubrick did everything himself, did he want to do everything himself? No, he says he was being forced. Why was he forced? Because he couldn't pay anyone to do it for him. That's why he had to. So it's not an artistic choice to do it yourself. It's a financial restriction. It's the dependence on a limited budget that forces him to do most things himself. He had to do these things simply to save money. Now, this whole idea of autonomy becomes even more complicated when we look at the film sale to RKO, because there's a whole debate about when that sale took place. Why is this debate important? It's important because we need to know what Kubrick sold them. Did he sell them? The one version is the film was completely finished the way we see it, and that's what the RKO sold, and they showed it that way. If you look at the dates, and you have to look at some sources from the time, you get a different timeline. You get a timeline whereby it is much more likely that Kubrick shot the film, probably did a rough cut, and then offered that to RKO. And RKO then gave him the money to hire Gerald Fried to work for months on end, because he'd never done it before, to actually compose the score and record it. That costs a lot of money. That's where a lot of the money goes. And secondly, RKO might even have hired a scriptwriter to write the voiceover narration. Because the voiceover narration is not credited to Kubrick. It's not credited to anyone that ever reappears in Kubrick's life. So it wasn't one of his mates. So the likelihood is that the voiceover narration, which is so fantastically Kubrickian that you want to quote it for the rest of your study of Kubrick, there's so much wonderful Kubrickian stuff in it, But it's quite likely that maybe in consultation with Kubik, someone else commissioned and wrote and recorded. And the guy who recorded the further piece of evidence was actually a leading newscaster. So once again, it's likely that the newscaster would have only gotten involved once it was sold to RKO, rather than hanging out with a bunch of amateur filmmakers and recording a voiceover for them. In any case, once the film was sold, RKO could do with it what it wanted. And in actual fact, there's two different versions of the film. One misses the whole opening sequence, which in some ways, thematically, is the richest sequence in the whole film. It's the sequence where it's about fight fans and why fight fans love to see men hitting each other. That's, for our purposes, actually quite a relevant sequence. That sequence is actually not available in some of the prints that you get of Day of the Fight. RKO was perfectly entitled, whatever the condition the film was when Kubrick gave it to RKO, they were perfectly entitled to do with it what they wanted. So this idea of autonomy that Lobruto talks about, it has to be taken so carefully. Yeah, because the autonomy is limited, the independence of Kubrick is limited in all these ways that I describe. Be that as it may, RKO liked Day of the Fight and immediately commissioned a second film, Flying Padre, about Dr. Fred Stadmüller, the guy who has a parish of tens of thousands of square miles and uses a plane in New Mexico to fly around and cater to his community, the members of his parish. He gets commissioned to do that. And since he's commissioned to do that, it's very clear that in this project, we have to assume that RKO had to be convinced of that this is a good topic or told him to do it, and that RKO supervised the whole process. Now, in all these cases, it's possible that RKO trusted Kubrick and let him just get on with it. But as we said, that's a limited autonomy, because RKO could at any time have told Kubrick to do things differently. Why would Kubrick accept that? Because that's how the world works. No, that's how Look magazine worked. Look magazine told picture stories. How were these picture stories created? He worked for five years full-time at Look magazine. Look magazine, how do they actually create picture stories? They have an editorial board. The editorial board gets pitched ideas. Someone pitches ideas for them, which might be a photographer, but very unlikely. Mostly it's editors. Then they decide which stories are going to be made. Then the editor sits down with researchers. The editor works with a team of researchers and the writer-photographer team. The researchers do the research on the topic. The topic is then translated by the editor together with the photographer into a storyboard. Yeah, like a script, like a film storyboard. The photographer decides with the editor on the basis of the research what the pictures are that need to be taken. The photographer then goes out with the writer just observes at that moment, takes the pictures, delivers the pictures back to the editor, and the editor then, maybe consulting the photographer, maybe not, sits down with the art department to decide which pictures to take exactly, because, you know, for each pictures that they want, they might have different takes. And they have to decide which one to take, and then they have to order them. They have to lay them out on the page. Once that is done, the writer has to write the text. The writer might consult with the photographer, very unlikely. So what we see here is actually a mode of production, as it were, which is very similar to how Hollywood operated in the 30s and 40s, and in documentary filmmaking, presumably still in the late 40s, early 50s, where there is an editor in Hollywood, we would call him a producer, where there are people on staff, and they, in a sense, do their little bit for the overall project. The only person in control of the overall project is the editor, because the editor coordinates everything. And that's the way that Kubrick was used to work. He was used to work under those conditions. He was not used to work as an artist photographer, who just takes the pictures he wants and then shows them in a gallery under his own. You know, he designs the frame and the hanging and whether this one is there or there. None of this applies to Kubrick. He was a staff photographer who worked in a system of highly detailed division of labor under control of an editor working for the magazine. And it's in that context that we have to understand his first forays into filmmaking. Whether, as in the case of Day of the Fight, he at least controlled the initiation of the project and the storyboarding and the shooting of the film himself, and perhaps even made suggestions about the editing, the layout, as it were. Whether that's the case or not, whether RKO controlled the whole production of Flying Padre from commissioning it to the final edit, that's irrelevant, because Kubrick would in any case have been completely familiar with the mode of production, where all he did ultimately, or all he ever had control of, was to shoot the pictures. And everything else was out of his control. That's what he was familiar with. And it's interesting in that context to think about, was he thinking about becoming, instead of being a staff stills photographer at Look magazine, to become a staff cinematographer with the occasional director credit for March of Time or This Is America. I forgot to say that March of Time didn't buy Day of the Fight. RKO bought it for how much? Hang on, let me see. I forgot to say that. Because that's a little bit of a punchline there. Because, you know, if they wanted to, you know, well, we make it for 4,000, we get 30,000. First of all, March of Time gave them so little money that they couldn't sell it to March of Time at all. And RKO paid them, if I can only find it. Can't find it. I have to find this one. 4,000. So if he made it for 3,900, that's a convenient figure, because that would mean he made $100 profit. I think the 4,500 figure is more likely. He lost money on the whole thing. So these guys, you know, they think, ah, we're going to screw the big guy. We're going to really milk them. They lost money on it. But then, of course, they got commissioned to do the next film. And since it's a commission, they at least get a salary, even if nothing else. So the whole thing as a money-making enterprise is completely disaster. As an idea of taking his role at Look magazine and just not being a staff photographer of stills at Look, but to become a staff cinematographer at Barge of Time or This Is America, it's a possibility. Now, there's two reasons to not think that that's what he wanted. The first one is the documentary market in the United States was collapsing at that time. Because at least for movie theaters, because a lot of that stuff went to television. It wasn't made at reasonably big budgets for the cinema anymore. It was made for television. So the whole documentary market collapses. For Kubrick to be so naive to think he could have a career in it is unlikely. But the second reason is that even before he started making Day of the Fight, he, like Alexander Singer, had already been working on his own feature film script. That's what I'm going to talk about after the break. But now I want to show you, with only 5 minutes delay, although I'm slightly cheating, I want to show you Kubrick's first ever movie. But think about all the things I said about who is actually responsible for this movie, who did what on that movie, how limited our knowledge is about who did what and to what extent Kubrick even approved of what is in this movie. Okay. Day of the Fight. It's about 15 minutes. And this is all very hush-hush. Very hush-hush.
Fight fan, short for